History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are always stories there that are worth hearing, stories that should not go untold. So we ask a few questions, we listen, and it's amazing the perspective we gain. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only do we learn a lot, not only are we educated and entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There's always a lot going on when November 11th rolls around on the calendar and hometowns all over America celebrate their veterans. It looked a little different this year because of COVID-19, call it the year of the virtual Veterans Day Parade, but so many things unfolded over the last week, and I'd like to draw your attention to at least a few of them today. For one, as of Veterans Day, the long-awaited National Museum of the U.S. Army is finally open at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, capturing nearly 250 years of Army history. Add that to your list the next time you visit the Washington, D.C. area. A day after that came news of the next group that's going to be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal, the nation's highest civilian honor, and it'll be the women who went to work to power the home front during World War II. Those Rosie the Riveters will be so honored. And you're going to hear from one of them in the coming weeks here on Hometown Heroes with enough energy and enthusiasm to run circles around most of us. I spent some time with many incredible people over the past week who have served our country, and I was reminded again of the power of our veterans and their palpable love for our country to bring the rest of us together. That was certainly the story in Visalia, California, where I got to watch five young ladies from Granite Hills High School in nearby Porterville present hand-sewn red, white, and blue patriotic blankets to veterans who will soon be experiencing an honor flight to Washington, D.C. By soon, I mean as soon as it's safe to do so, but these high school students gave up their lunch hours for a semester to make this moment possible. The looks on some of those veterans' faces told a more powerful story than I could possibly tell here, but I can share a few more layers to that story with you. One link I have up for you at hometownheroesradio.com is to a video piece by photojournalist Craig Colrus of the Fresno Bee, and in it you'll hear Chloe Ross, the founder of the Heartwarmers Club, explain the motivation behind that movement.
Heartwarmers is a community service club that I started at Granite Hills High School in Porterville. Our mission is to make blankets for those in need, and we've donated them to various community service organizations. This was a set that I started because of my great-grandfather, who was a Pearl Harbor survivor and a World War II veteran. When I saw that he was supposed to go on the flight in April, I really wanted to do something special to honor veterans. And so I rallied about 40 members who met every week in my high school classroom. And we made around 75 blankets for the veterans who were supposed to be on that flight. My great-grandfather was supposed to go on the flight in April, but he passed away in January. It's really sad for me. It's big in our family because of the service that my grandfather did. And so growing up with that kind of mindset and thankfulness for the freedoms that we have because of these veterans is very important to me. I'm really excited that we were able to do something like this. Unfortunately, we can't have our big parades. I'm involved in band, so Veterans Day Parade is always something super exciting for me. And so I was super sad that we weren't able to do that this year, but I'm glad that there was another way that we could honor these veterans.
The tears in their eyes and the emotion on their faces made it clear those veterans felt honored. Hats off to Chloe Ross and the Heartwarmers from Granite Hills High School in Porterville, California. And since she mentioned the inspiration behind that effort, her great-grandfather, who passed away before he could experience an honor flight to Washington, D.C., I want you to hear some of his story to round out your perspective. A native of Burley, Idaho, Chuck Keene joined the Navy in February 1941. We pick up his memories with the night of December 6, 1941, in Pearl Harbor, where the then 19-year-old was assigned to the cruiser USS Honolulu.
I was down and getting ready to do my first night of mess cooking aboard ship. At that time, everybody had to do 6 weeks of mess cooking, and that was the old chief cook was showing us all the things that we had to do, how to fix the trays. I was going to put the trays and wash, after the guys had eaten, I washed the trays and put them in a rack. That was going to be my job when I got up the next morning, and that's what I got up to. Is we no more started breakfast, and the general quarters alarm rang. I ran topside, and here was a Japanese Zero coming right down the dock, just strafing the hell out of things, you know. We didn't know, had never had any training on being under gunfire. I compare it to taking, pulling a little spool in the dirt, running along behind and seeing the dust come up behind a spool in the alleyway. Well, that's the way those bullets were coming down that thing. And we never had brain wanted to duck or anything like that. We just watched it go by. Everybody was just sort of in awe at because we'd never seen a plane like that. Every plane that they showed us had two wings and big propellers.
So, yeah, I mean, clearly this was shocking. This was unexpected. So what did you do when you came topside and you saw all that? What did you do with yourself?
Well, my buddy, Freeberg, from Seattle, we were topside searchlights, big searchlights. We had to man those searchlights. Well, it seemed sort of dumb to do anything with a searchlight in broad daylight. So we were down helping wherever we could, and I was helping try to get ammunition to these 3-inch guns because they had no provisions for that. They had a locker full of them, and so we'd throw the locker open and try to keep shells enough for the guns, and then the gun got hot and it jammed, and we just had all kinds of problems. Then you'd go to the next one. We just sort of all over the ship the first day until we were hit. They come by, they dropped a bomb, and it hit the dock and exploded underneath the ship and caved our whole front of the ship in, a 500-pound bomb, and so we couldn't go anywhere because our magazine had collapsed, and they were afraid it was going to blow up. And so the next 3 days, I spent myself down in my shorts and skivvies, you would say, and with stockings, and going down there sweeping up gunpowder with a foxtail and by the pail to get it out of there to where it's a miracle we didn't blow up right then, you know. But the only thing that they said that saved us was it collapsed the peak tanks where the water was. Forced the water right back into the magazine, and so it didn't explode. That's why I'm still here, because if that had gone off, we'd all been gone. But
well, and I know there are a couple other moments throughout the war where you might not have been here if it didn't go a certain way. But I'm wondering, while you're doing all this and this is happening, while you realize your ship is under attack, did you ever have a chance to look out and see what else was happening throughout Pearl Harbor?
They flew right by our fantailed, the torpedo bombers that were torpedoing the battleships come right by. They swoop down into the water just in back of our ship and launch their torpedoes for the battleships. We had what they call a blister. Those torpedoes didn't do much damage to the ship because they put right in 39 or somewhere along there. They put what they call 6-inch blisters on the battleship, so they decided to make him so the torpedoes wouldn't hit them. They pretty well sheltered it off, but the ones that got all of it was the armor pierced, and they flew and they dropped the bombs down, and they come down through the deck that way and exploded. But the big explosion we heard was the Shaw and two ships in dry dock. They exploded. And that just, like, crushed me. It killed one guy on the dock because, you see, the docks have a revetment alongside there that you can put stuff back in, that's cinder block or whatever it is like that, and all of your weapons and everything were stored back in that area. Well, this guy was standing in there, so when the blast that hit me went on through, it hit him, but it come off the back of that thing, and he just crushed him. And that's the first time that I saw a guy just dead by explosion. I mean, it just killed him.
Well, and you said something about yourself feeling that too. So what did you feel? What did you experience?
My experience was just like somebody grabbed me and just crushed my lungs. And I couldn't, for a minute, I didn't think I was ever going to really breathe again. It marked me so that even after the war, sudden sounds for a long time. They never had any therapy or any way to treat us for it, but if sudden sound would shake, and I'd be shaking inside. You know, I could hold my hands here, but it seemed like everything inside was jerking. It takes several hours for that to go away. I had that for years, you know, every sudden noises or something shake. But that big damage that I had was that explosion aboard that dry dock.
Well, that's one of the most captivating photos from Pearl Harbor, is the Shaw. Yeah, the concussion of that explosion smacked you in the chest.
Smashed me, yeah. It knocked me down. I couldn't stand. I mean, I went down. I didn't know what had happened to me. And then I got up. You can't imagine getting hit. Well, if you played football or something, you might, but it's not really as hard because it crushes you from both sides. You just feel like everything's coming out your mouth.
So, again, this is a 19-year-old kid from Idaho who's been living in paradise, and now his world is turned upside down. And I was struck by something you wrote down for your family, a few memories, when you said, "We were attacked on December 7th, 1941 by the Japanese." You wrote, "Our fleet was destroyed, and so was my innocence." What did you mean by that?
Well, I'd never seen death before. I'd never seen that my kind of suffering. I never did, and never have since. The worst day of the war was the worst day of my life. It was awful. It all seemed like it all run together to the 11th, to December 11th. It seemed like there was no night or day. We were just trying to clean up, you know. We still had guys trapped underwater. We had guys trying to get out. We had a lot of 2,000 guys burned laying on the dock trying to take care of them. It was just a big mess for till the 11th. Then we finally, they said, well, on the 11th, they came out and said, well, we're going to go back to San Francisco, because we didn't know how much damage it had on the ship, but it was extensive, and we had to go get it fixed. So that put us back in perspective, and it calmed down a little bit. We had some of our ships, planes trying to fly in from one of the other airports to fly in there, and our guys were so gun-shy, they were shooting at our own planes.
And you mentioned sweeping up the gunpowder to try to avoid a secondary explosion.
Yeah.
What else were you doing for those next few days after the attack?
Mostly repairing the bulkhead so the ship could get out. And believe it or not, we had to use timber. We had timber on there. I never dreamed that they'd have it on there, but we had 4x4s, 4x6, and so we could block that side of the ship if we got underway, that it wouldn't cave in any more than where it was. So I was being carpenter for part of the time, and tying things up. We tied everything up that we could, and just got rid of all the junk on there. Anything that we didn't need to go to war, you got rid of. You'd be surprised how much crap you'd get aboard a ship, you know, that you don't need.
And, you know, we know with the lens of history, we know that the Japanese came in two waves that day to Oahu, and they were also hitting other places like the Philippines and Clark Field. But you guys didn't know if they were coming back to Oahu again after December 7th. Was there a concern that more was coming in the days that followed?
Yes. They were sure that there's going to be carriers in there, and they never realized that he'd turned these carriers around and gone back to Japan. But according to the amount of fuel and weaponry and everything that we had on ours, we could figure they could have come right on in. So we were under alert entirely. For the next, I guess they stayed on alert even after we got out of there, and they wanted everything that could move and get out, because they figured another more attack. One of the most vivid things is cutting the guy's mouth open to find how many teeth they had so they could identify them, but they didn't have an ID card or tag. The only way you could check them would be with their dental records. You just had to pry open the guy's mouth to count the teeth. That was horrible to me. I mean, to this day, I've never got over that, but we had to do it. You had to find out who they were, and most of them, they successfully located a lot of them, but some they didn't, which, you know, there's 408, I think, of the ones that first day that they couldn't identify.
You got put on a detail to go bury some of them?
Yes, I was on a detail to bury them. I was also on the detail when we were identifying the ones that were seriously hurt. Some of the hangars on the island were, we collected them, but they buried up above Honolulu, up there on the thing. I really have trouble with that because I was up there, but I couldn't tell anybody how you get up there to it, you know, but it was a hill.
It's the Punch Bowl crater, which is now an American cemetery. A lot of people go to the Arizona Memorial and everything that's around Pearl Harbor, but the Punch Bowl is one of the most moving places I've ever been.
That's where we put them in, and we never had identification for all of them, and on the ones that we didn't, they put their dental records, or and keep in mind that it's 72 degrees, it's hot, and you know what happens to bodies when it gets warm, they go to swelling, and we had to get them buried. And so that shocked me that we couldn't do any more than what we did. We just took a string and tied it around their neck and put their ID up on the post. So, and that's the way but they were the lucky ones. They were the ones that could be identified, and some of them didn't, you know, we didn't know it. And then they would put their dental record up there.
And the ones that weren't identified in recent years, there's been an exhumation, and they have gone back, and they've been able to identify quite a few of those sailors.
I sort of blocked that out of my mind. I knew they were doing it. They were covering guys up. That's what the way that it was told to me. A chief told me, he says, they're covering them up. And I knew that he meant they were just burying them.
Well, and you underscore the urgency of doing that for just physical reasons. But did it weigh on you at the time that those people, those victims of this attack, were not identified, and that their families would not have that final answer?
That didn't bother me. The thing that bothered me more than anything else is they gave me morphine. And for all of them that were crying or hollering, you know, for something, he just said, just give them a shot of morphine. Well, we were going along there, we were shoving morphine into those guys, and I thought I'd killed about 400, and I never knew until the nurse come here that I couldn't. You know, I had that on my mind for 60 years that I helped kill them, but they say I didn't, so I got some relief from that. But she said that if you put morphine into a muscle, it's not going to kill anybody, you know, with the dose that we give. But if it went into a vein or an artery, it could, but where you just put it in the arm, it didn't. They said you give them relief. And I know from being an explosion myself that morphine will certainly do away with pain right away. I myself screamed for it in an explosion aboard John C. Butler. I mean, one of the main connections exploded while I was trying to show the yard superintendent what was happening, and it just boom, it arced, and no fuse, no nothing. It's tied into the main energy on the dock. We just melted a hole, and we had a half-inch steel. Just melted down, and it knocked me out. I don't know what happened that I got out, but when I came to, I was in a van, and they had a pull motor on me. I think that's probably as close to dead as I've ever been, because I can always remember just like circles of gray just going back and forth, and all of a sudden I realized I'm moving, and they had me in an ambulance taking me to the Naval Hospital in Long Beach.
Chuck Keen was a witness to incredible death and destruction at Pearl Harbor. That last story illustrates how close he came to death himself. And this isn't melodrama, this is reality. If he had not survived that and more during World War II, 70 California veterans would not be enjoying those comfy red, white, and blue blankets this holiday season, because his great-granddaughter, Chloe Ross, would have never been here to launch that Heartwarmers Club inspired by Chuck's service in World War II. You can link to Mr. Keene's complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a new way of telling World War II stories that's appealing to a whole new generation. I don't think I've ever directed you to Netflix before, but wait till you hear about The Liberator. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Pro proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, trying to take stock this week of just a few things that made Veterans Day 2020 unique and special. November 11th, 2020 was a groundbreaking day in one way I don't think I ever thought I'd mention. A new filmmaking technique brought a powerful World War II story to life in a combination of live action and animation that you have to see to truly understand. It's adapted from the best-selling book, The Liberator, by Alex Kershaw. Our troops around the world have access to it, and so do you, as a four-part series that debuted on Veterans Day on Netflix. You've heard Alex Kershaw on this program before talking about Felix Sparks, the real-life hero he wrote about in The Liberator. And before we get Alex's reaction to this new graphic novel on screen, if you will, listen to a portion of the trailer, which you can see in its entirety at hometownheroesradio.com.
My dearest Mary, when I left you to come over here, I was scared of losing you. I'm scared of not coming back. I'm scared of dying.
Let's go!
But I began this war with a group of men.
Hang in there, Captain.
Men who I owed a debt to.
Go! Go!
Captain, you're not ready for discharge. You walk out of here and you'll be AWOL.
They would send me home, sir. I ought to be with my men. Mary, I don't expect you to understand. It isn't my time to come home yet.
Dios mío, it's the captain.
He came back.
I'm not scared anymore.
Those men, they're the descendants of the powerful Mexican army.
Let's go!
That defeated the French on Cinco de Mayo.
Vamos! Vamos!
They're sons of Texas Rangers who brought the rule of law. They're the grandsons of the greatest Indian warriors to roam the American plains. They're my men.
Those men featured in this new four-part Netflix series depicted in such a new and revolutionary way are the ones that Alex Kershaw wrote about in The Liberator. Alex was kind enough to take some time to talk to us about what this project means.
The amazing thing is that I think about all the guys that I interviewed, and I think about Sparks and, you know, beautiful people that are no longer around, and to have them come back to life for such a large audience, for kids, for, you know, there's so many young Italian kids that are really into this show right now. It's trending really high on Netflix in Italy. You know, they're big fans of Bradley James, who plays Sparks. But there's an awful lot of kids around the world that are really falling in love with American liberators and the Thunderbirds and World War II, and they're seeing Americans in a really fantastic light, in the best possible light. They're seeing working class white guys, working class Mexican Americans, Native Americans, just amazing, amazing Americans. They're seeing what they really did, and they're seeing how they liberated their country. They're seeing how they liberated France and Italy, how they liberated Germany from Nazism, and they're seeing the best thing that America ever did, which was to destroy Nazism. It's a fantastic thing to have, you know, countless millions of people really get into this story and in a way validate, you know, what I spent so long worrying about and trying to put into a book. And, you know, I remember when the book came out in October of 2012, I didn't get a single press interview on Veterans Day. I remember sitting in the kitchen, and I'm being really honest now, I remember standing in the kitchen and I literally almost banged my head against the new granite surface in my kitchen. And I was like, what the hell? Why? These guys were amazing. This is one of the greatest achievements in military history, the 157th Infantry Regiment. What they did was incredible, and I'm like, no one's interested? It took me a long time to kind of reconcile that lack of interest. I thought to myself, what the hell am I doing? I remember going up to talk to my wife and saying, why have I been spending 20 years writing books about World War II and these guys? And is it worth it? Is anybody really interested? And so, cut a long story short, you know, 10 years later, I'm thinking, I'm really glad finally that people are really starting to pay attention. And it's truth. People watch TV and they love great drama. And, you know, the guy that wrote this is one of the best in the business. And certainly when it comes to action, he's a legend. It's Jeb Stuart. He did Die Hard, The Fugitive. He's done an absolutely fantastic job. As I watched the 4 hours, I was like, I hadn't seen it. I was not shown anything. I deliberately stayed out of the production process. I didn't want to. I thought, you know, these people are creative. They want to have their own take. They don't want someone like me looking over their shoulder and saying that's the wrong patch or whatever. I just like, just leave them alone. Let them get on with it. Let them have their vision. And maybe hopefully it'll mesh with mine. So when I'm watching the show, I'm thinking, oh my God, they took that bit and they took that bit and they took that bit. And not only were they very faithful to the main arc of Sparks's, Felix Sparks's, the Liberator's journey, but they were also, there were some things in the book that I was like, wow, where the hell did that come from? When I watched the show, and it was a fantastic example. I was sat there watching with my wife and in between blubbing, because I cried an awful lot. I think mainly because it was very emotional to watch these guys come back to life, because I was very, you know, I was really close to one guy in particular. At least I felt very close to him. And that's a guy called Halliwell, who was a character in the Netflix show that's called Halliwell. It's not the same guy, but they used the name, which was really nice. And I devoted the book to Jack Halliwell, who's no longer around. And he just pushed me so hard to write the story. He pestered me for a couple of years, called me every 6 months and said, you've got to write a story about Felix Sparks. You've got to see him before he dies. You've got to do this. So if it hadn't been for Jack Halliwell, this would never have happened. So anyway, I'm watching the show and blubbing along and laughing, and I suddenly saw these two characters, and it was a father and son. You know, and a lot of people are going to think, there's no such thing in World War II as a father serving side by side with his son in the 45th Infantry Division, the Thunderbird Division. They made that up. And you know what? They didn't make it up. There actually was a father and son. And there's a photograph in my book, it's one of the most extraordinary photographs. And it's an Anzio, and it shows the father and his son, you know, and the son, I think the father was about to leave to go back to the US. And it's like, I remember when I looked at the photograph thinking, what the hell did they say to each other when they were in the war, you know? So in the Netflix show, there's actually a couple of characters there, and mainly in the third episode. It's the father and son. It's not the same father and son that actually were in World War II, but it's a father and son. So there's lots of things like that that I loved, because they took the factual history. They were true to the essence of it, but they turned it into drama, which was lovely, you know. It's just really nice to see.
So if I'm understanding correctly, you spent Veterans Day, 4 hours of Veterans Day, watching for the first time your book, which is the true story of so many veterans of World War II, being turned into this one-of-a-kind dramatization that's going to reach a whole different audience from the audience any of your books have reached. I mean, that's kind of like a whole new world for you, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a whole new world for World War II. It's a whole new world for TV. It's a, you know, very, very, it's the first time this has ever been done with the technique they've used, the rotoscope technique that Trioscope Studios have pioneered. So this is the first time you're going to see World War II shown like this. And in fact, any story, this is the very first time that this has been used. So it's really new. It's very fresh. It's very interesting. And so far, it's doing really, really well. I mean, it's trending on Netflix in the top 10. So far, people are really loving it, you know, especially young people and people that probably wouldn't go anywhere near a World War II book, probably wouldn't watch a black and white documentary on the History Channel. They're not the generation that grew up with Band of Brothers. You know, that's over 20, it's 20 years ago now. I mean, these are people that are teenagers and in their 20s that it just wouldn't come to World War II unless it was something like this, unless it was something that looked a little bit like a video game brought to life, to real life. So, yeah, this is World War II is the most important story of our time. And to get a whole bunch of new people really passionate about it and really interested in it again is, you know, hats off to Cryoscope and Netflix and A&E Studios and all the amazing cast, and, you know, Bradley James, my fellow Brit, the actor who plays Felix Sparks, did an absolutely superb job. Really, really sublime, really, really calm and forceful and really moving performance. Just a really, really great actor. So I'm delighted. I hope I don't sound like I'm not delighted, but I am. I'm over the moon, you know?
Well, and because it's a new technique, I'm guessing you really didn't know what to expect because you've never seen anything that was done in this fashion. So as you watched all four of those hours, was there one moment in there that really kind of took your breath away, the way they interpreted something that you had written, something that had been shared with you by these veterans themselves, that the way they brought to life on screen really got to you?
Yeah, I think my favorite episode is 4 hours, and my favorite episode is the third episode, which I just thought was spectacular storytelling. It was sort of definition of visual storytelling in a really powerful, beautiful way, very, very tense. And it's set in the Vosges Mountains. It's the Battle of Reipersweiler in January 1945, and Sparks lost his entire battalion except for two guys. Actually, one of them is still alive, a veteran, Bernard Fleming, who's 98. He's one of the only two guys that escaped the encirclement of the battalion that Sparks commanded at Reipersweiler. The SS surrounded the battalion and picked them off, and Sparks lost, Sparks had lost, the Liberators had lost his entire company at Anzio, and then to lose a battalion at January 1945 was heartbreaking. So in the show, it was just really, really beautifully done. And the effect of the snow, the visuals, one of the things that the producers have said, and Jeb Stuart, the creator and the writer, have said, to make 8-hour, 10-hour World War II drama, but it's live action, it's going to cost you $150, $200 million, maybe even more. You know, it's very, very expensive to do. And when you try and do it, how can you have big scenes, big battles shown? There aren't any tanks that you can really employ. You can't find 25 Panzers. You just can't create the scale and the epic feel of the story. Even if you had all the money in the world, you can't find the actual real resources anymore. The B-17s, whatever you see in the show, you just can't muster that anymore. So this is probably the only way that you can do it, is to animate it so that you see the live facial expressions, you see the acting of the actors. So you're looking at real actors and action, but the backdrop, how they fit into the scenes is amazing, because you're seeing this vast, beautiful, epic scenes of entire battlefields and mountains, and it's beautiful. You know, you've got artists that are taking great actors, and they're amplifying what they're doing by placing them in beautiful backdrops in incredible scenes.
Well, and I know it's only the first week that this has been out, but seeing how this came together and the impression that it's making and the new audience that it's reaching, I have to wonder if some of the other many World War II books you've written may end up finding their way to this format themselves.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to have the whole lot, year after year. I'd love to, but I think that it's very exciting to think that Thunderbird patch that those guys wore, the 157th Infantry Regiment and the 45th Infantry Division, those guys are being rediscovered and maybe will be better known around the world than they ever have been. There were so many divisions, U.S. divisions, that fought in Europe in World War II. And you know as well as I do that after D-Day, 6th of June 1944, the 36th Division, the 3rd Division, the 45th Division, all those guys that had fought so hard in Italy, they were forgotten about. They were actually disparaged as D-Day dodgers, guys that had missed out on the big one, D-Day, June the 6th, 1944. But by June the 6th, 1944, Felix Sparks had been in three amphibious invasions. You know, he invaded Sicily, he invaded Salerno, he invaded Anzio. They were not D-Day dodgers. They had at least three behind them already by the time that June the 6th occurred. They became the kind of forgotten warriors of World War II and the liberation. And it's a shame, because they were there at the start and they were there at the end. They spent the longest time that you could spend in combat was with the 3rd Division. They were the sister division in the corps that went through France with the 45th and the 36th. The 3rd Division, the 36th and the 45th have certainly, the 45th have been forgotten by most people, and yet they spent the second longest time in combat. They were had fantastic generals. They were a really, really amazing outfit. They saved the entire Allied bridgehead at Anzio in February 1944. You know, they did so many very, very important things that were forgotten about. And it's great that they're no longer forgotten. It's fantastic that they're no longer forgotten. It's amazing.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth, but I can't help but wonder as you say that, and you mentioned that there are a couple of these guys who are still living that were part of the 45th Infantry Division. I know it hasn't been very long, but have you had a chance to talk to any of them about their reactions to seeing this?
No, I haven't. I haven't been in touch with any of them. I'm sure I will be. There's in the show, there's a guy called Carl Mann. It's called Mann, and he's the Liberator's interpreter, and he's actually in several scenes. So Carl's still alive. He's a German. He was obviously he was the interpreter because he could speak fluent German, and he's still around, isn't he? In Pennsylvania, and I spoke to him about 6 months ago. His hearing's not very good at all, so he can't do interviews over the phone. But I managed by shouting very loud to have a good chat with him back like 4 or 5 months ago. So yeah, I hope they're all really happy with it, and they're watching it maybe right now as we speak. I think I hope they'll be really, really happy. I hope they're as happy as I am.
Well, I think a lot of people will be happy, and I want to say congratulations for having this moment. I know you've worked toward it for a long time, and look forward to seeing more of the same. Anything else you think people ought to know about the Liberator or how they should interpret what they see?
Well, I think it's what's interesting about the unit that Sparks led was that, you know, it drew from the American Southwest, sort of units from Oklahoma, Colorado, New Mexico, that part of the United States, and they had an awful lot of Native Americans. The 45th Infantry Division had the largest number of Native Americans of any U.S. combat division in World War II. When they left the U.S., there were over 1,500 Native Americans in that division, which, as you know, is a lot, an awful lot. And I think over 40 different tribes. It was also had a lot of Mexican Americans, guys that couldn't really even speak English very well. In fact, one of the survivors today from the regiment, a guy called Guy Prestia, he actually had to write letters for a Mexican American friend of his because the guy couldn't write English, and he had to write these letters for him back to his family to get past the census, etc. So yeah, there's an awful lot. My point is, there's an awful lot of Native Americans, an awful lot of Mexican Americans, and this was about as integrated a unit, about as diverse and integrated a combat unit, an American combat unit that you could find in World War II. It grew from very, very, very different, diverse immigrant groups. And when you watch the show, you'll see that Bradley James, obviously, he's a white guy. He's playing Sparks. But the of the three kind of key characters that you see quite a lot, one of them is Mexican-American and one of them is a Native American. So we're seeing a very diverse image, a very colored face of World War II here. And I think it's long overdue. I think it's time that people really remember that there are an awful lot of minorities that fought very, very hard. In fact, the most decorated regiment was Japanese-American. The blacks in the 92nd Infantry Division, the Black Panthers, the Tuskegee Airmen, so many minorities in America fought and gave everything and laid down their lives for their country, for America. So I think their contributions are often being forgotten, that we tend to see World War II as a white victory for white Americans, and it was a victory for all Americans from all different races and backgrounds.
Absolutely. And our veterans and their stories have the power to unite us still today. That is Alex Kershaw, his book, The Liberator, now a Netflix series. I hope you're going to check it out. We are way overdue for a break, but when we come back, something I had a chance to write this week that I'd like to share with you, and a way you can take it even further. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, there are six more weekends in 2020, so that means at least six more remarkable veterans we're going to get to meet on this program. Veterans Day always prods me to look back and think about so many who we've had the privilege of meeting here, and so many who are no longer with us. But one project I was asked to be a part of this last week made me take stock of some of the incredible examples of living, breathing history who are still with us. Amtrak has a network of trains called the San Joaquins, running from California's Bay Area to the state capital in Sacramento and down through the heart of the San Joaquin Valley all the way to Bakersfield. I was asked to compose some thoughts to share with the riders of those trains this Veterans Day, and I do realize that with this audience, I'm probably preaching to the choir, but I thought I would read that to you here. It includes some of the incredible Americans you've met on this program. And if you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find an interactive version of this with links to each veteran's story. So here we go. Here's what I wrote. Each November, America pauses to recognize the courageous men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. No state in our union is home to more veterans than California. And every single day, veterans are moving about the Golden State on the Amtrak San Joaquins. During World War II, some of the same train stops you navigate today were the settings for both tearful goodbyes and joyful reunions. 16 million Americans served in our armed forces during World War II, and more than 406,000 of them never had the chance to return home to their families. The National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. honors their memory, and the Honor Flight Network sprouted from a desire to take surviving veterans to our nation's capital to pay tribute to those who made the ultimate sacrifice. Between Honor Flight Kern County, Central Valley Honor Flight, and Honor Flight Bay Area, any World War II, Korean War, or Vietnam War veteran in the territory serviced by Amtrak San Joaquins has an all-volunteer organization ready to provide free of charge that inimitable experience that is equal parts gratitude, camaraderie, and catharsis. And I would add that wherever you're listening today in America, there's an Honor Flight there that can do the same for the veteran in your life. Continuing what I wrote, beyond volunteering or contributing to Honor Flight or other veteran-centric charities, there's a simple step each one of us can take to make every day feel like Veterans Day for those who have served. It's not a matter of if, but when you're going to encounter someone with a cap signifying veteran status. Consider that your invitation. After you thank that veteran for his or her service, gently and respectfully present a few simple questions. When did you serve? Which branch? Where did Uncle Sam send you? The conversation may last 30 seconds or less, or perhaps it'll branch out into 30 minutes or more. Regardless of where your interaction lands on that spectrum, your willingness to listen will mean more to the veteran than you might ever understand. A glance at the map of stations for the Amtrak San Joaquins brings to mind some of the amazing Americans you might encounter. Beautifully diverse along ethnic, religious, political, and socioeconomic lines, they were united then and remain united now by their ironclad devotion to our nation. At the Martinez stop in the East Bay, it could be Harold Bray, who joined the Navy at age 17 and survived 4 days in the water after the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. In Sacramento, it might be John Chavez, who still has shrapnel in his head from his World War II Army days, but went on to serve in the Air Force in the Korean War and Vietnam War. In Modesto, asking Francis O'Brien about his missing finger might yield some fascinating tales from his Marine Corps years. Keep chugging down the tracks to Merced County, and you may have the privilege of getting to know Sherman Kishi or Frank Paredes. One of 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry to serve in World War II, Kishi volunteered from an internment camp where his family was being detained behind barbed wire. Paredes, one of America's few remaining Pearl Harbor survivors, was one of 16 children in his Native American family. Sit next to the resilient David McCoy in Hanford, and you'd never guess he endured the horrors of Omaha Beach on D-Day. In between the Wasco and Bakersfield stations in Kern County resides Mert Weedman, a pharmacist who will fill your prescription for a thrill ride with his mission to fly into a typhoon. Stepping off in Fresno, ask lifelong nurse Jane Boot to explain why she once reprimanded legendary General Jimmy Doolittle. Or visit one of the last surviving Chinese-American veterans of World War II, Ray Lee, and find out why a room at a local museum is named in his honor. If only my friend Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, a pioneering African-American heart surgeon, were still here to illuminate the comical misunderstanding that led to the then-segregated Army classifying him as a Caucasian. No, these veterans and their amazing, eye-opening, and inspiring stories will not be here forever. Regardless of when, where, and how they served, they devoted some of the best years of their lives to a calling greater than themselves. In some manner, visible or invisible, seemingly large or seemingly small, they contributed to the price of our freedom as Americans. On Veterans Day and every day, may we not neglect to express our gratitude, but let's go a step or two further. Let's ask a few questions and genuinely listen with an ear for understanding. Armed with the perspective that will inevitably bring, let us live in such a way that would assign a value to our freedom that measures up to the price they've paid. Well, if those words meant anything to you and you'd like to share them, you can find that entire piece at hometownheroesradio.com. More importantly, each of the names of those veterans I mentioned there are clickable. So when you click, it'll pull up their unique stories for you. Just a small sample. There are so many stories, so many incredible veterans. What a powerful example they've given us, and what a standard we have to pursue. Thanks again to Amtrak San Joaquins for the opportunity to share those sentiments with the fine folks on their trains, and for giving me the impetus to share that with you today. This hour went by really quickly today, but thank you so much for spending the hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that on Veterans Day and every day, our freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.